Welcome to Australia's Future with Tony Abbott. I'm Daniel Wilde from the Institute of Public Affairs. Australia is facing its most significant challenges since World War II. Geopolitical tensions are increasing, cultural self-confidence is in decline. The values which define us, freedom, democracy, egalitarianism, and sacrifice, are being put to the test. Over this special podcast series, Tony and I discuss how Australia can survive and flourish in the decades ahead. Well, hello, Tony, and g'day to all of our listeners. Great to be back with you for another episode of Australia's Future with Tony Abbott. We're very much looking forward to today's discussion. We're going to be talking further about the voice to Parliament and the idea of recognition, discussing the issue with the Victorian Liberals and their plummeting primary vote, plus also the critical issue of the presumption of innocence as it relates to the case of Ben Robert Smith and also the ongoing Brittany Higgins issue. Tony, great to be chatting with you again today. Let's kick off with the voice to Parliament. Earlier this week, some polling showing that support for the voice is below 50% on a national basis, and three states are now in the no column, which would be enough to stop the change taking place. We've seen a media engagement by the Yes campaign. Now, very clearly, they're wanting to say, look, the voice is just about recognition. It's the only form of recognition Indigenous people will accept. I'll just give you one example of that. Early this week in the Australian Financial Review, one of the Yes campaigners, Thomas Mayer, said that an Indigenous voice to Parliament and constitutional recognition went hand in hand. This is simply not true. Yourself, John Howard, many others have talked about other forms of constitutional recognition. Tony, what are your thoughts on this idea that the voice and constitutional recognition are one of the same?
Well, you're right, Dan. Recognition is quite separate from the voice. The voice goes way, way beyond recognition. The voice is all about power. It's a power grab by activists. It's an attempt to give less than 4% of the population a special say over what happens to 100% of the population. It really is the most illiberal measure imaginable. It injects race into the constitution. It entrenches separatism, which is at the heart of Indigenous disadvantage, and it gums up government even further, because that's inevitable when you've got an Indigenous voice to everyone on everything, which the High Court will say has to be taken extremely seriously indeed. So look, this is not recognition. This is way, 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 way beyond recognition. And that's why it's such a problem. You're right, Dan. John Howard committed the Coalition to Constitutional Recognition of Indigenous People back in 2007. It's been our policy ever since. It's been a bipartisan position ever since. But somehow recognition has mutated, or metastasized, if you like, into this whole question of the voice. Now, I'd be more than happy to see the preamble to the Constitution amended, as we've discussed before, to provide after one indivisible federal commonwealth with an Indigenous heritage, a British foundation, and an immigrant character under the Crown, etc. I'd be more than happy to see that happen. I'd be more than happy to see the Recognition Act of 2013, which was passed without dissent by the Parliament, incorporate into the Constitution. You could even, if there has to be a voice, you could even, as a voice advocate, say that the voice will be there for any laws passed under Section 5126. But no, that's not what they want. They want the voice to have a constitutionally entrenched right to make representations to the Parliament and to the executive government on everything. This idea that you hear from voice supporters that, if the Parliament has a constitutional right to make laws for the people of any race, well, the people of that race should have a constitutional right to be consulted. That's not what the voice in practice is about. It's not about consultation on laws under 5126. It's about an effective veto on every single aspect of government.
Now, that's right. There's a couple of good points you make there. I mean, the first is that the Voice doesn't recognise Indigenous Australians, because the whole idea of recognition is to say, in one form or the other, Indigenous people were here prior to European settlement. You know, and there's different ways of framing that, but that's the basic idea. It doesn't do that. It just says we're going to have this voice, and that's recognition, so you have to take it or leave it. The other point you make about consultation, well, you can do that now.
Well, exactly.
Why do we need to do this in order to do that?
Exactly right, Dan. When I was Prime Minister, I had an Indigenous Advisory Council chaired by Warren Mundine and comprising some very distinguished Indigenous Australians. I took that very seriously in all of the policies that I adopted for Indigenous people. Obviously, we had ATSIC, which was a bit of a disaster, but that was an earlier attempt to have institutionalised consultations. There have been bodies set up pre-ATSIC, which weren't very successful. The basic problem is, if you're living in a remote Indigenous settlement, you're kind of consulted to death because everything is supposed to be self-managed as opposed to just done in the normal way by people who are professional at getting it done. I mean, these remote settlements, which may have fewer than 500 people living there, they're supposed to run their own councils, they're supposed to provide their own utilities, they're supposed to manage their own clinics, they're supposed to run their own schools. If you're an Indigenous person living in a remote settlement, you spend your whole life going to meetings. The problem, of course, is that in the end, regardless of what those meetings say, the wheels of government turn incredibly slowly, and bureaucrats in the various capitals will often stop what you want. For instance, I was talking to a senior resources executive who is desperately trying to develop gas fields in the Northern Territory, and he was telling me the other day that the locals are all on side. They're all on side. But the powers that be, probably for climate reasons, are finding ways to obstruct it. So look, I am all in favour of listening to Aboriginal people. Frankly, we spend a lot of time listening to Aboriginal people. Often it's the wrong Aboriginal people. In the end, nothing gets done. And another Canberra bureaucracy is just going to make a bad situation worse.
Yeah, well, you mentioned your Indigenous Advisory Committee headed by Warren Mundine. We actually had Warren here last night addressing an IPA event, and he reminded me of that committee. And in many ways, what you set up was quite visionary, I think, because it was about the economic development and about, you know, Warren's very big on business development and having economic opportunity in these remote areas. And that seems to be something that's been largely forgotten about, where, you know, the basics, as you've always said, Tony, jobs, school and law and order. Well, any community that doesn't have those things is going to be dysfunctional no matter where you are. But we've seemed to have moved away from that basic practical understanding.
Well, this is exactly right. I mean, we do not need yet more consultation and yet more process. We need different outcomes. And the obvious outcomes, if we are going to get better lives for Indigenous people, is kids go to school, the adults go to work, and the communities are safe. And you don't need yet another bureaucracy to bring that about. You want the will that says that we should have the same expectations of Indigenous people that we have of all Australians, namely that the kids go to school, the adults go to work, and everyone obeys the law of the land. But for the last 50-odd years, there's been this notion of difference and separatism. We shouldn't, out of guilt over the past, we shouldn't have the same expectations of Aboriginal people as we do of everyone else. And at the heart of the problem with the Voice is that this is just the latest and the most egregious manifestation of this idea that Aboriginal people are different and have to be dealt with separately to that of every other Australian.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, the building blocks of a dignified and flourishing life don't depend on the colour of your skin. I mean, surely that's something that we shouldn't
this
be debating.
This is the fundamental liberal ideal, the fundamental liberal ideal that every human being, regardless of race or creed or colour or gender, has the same dignity, the same rights, the same responsibilities.
Related to this is, you know, we often hear this idea that, well, the voice, Indigenous people want the voice and they're pushing for the voice. There was some polling today reported in The Australian from, I gather it's from this group called Passing the Message Stick, which is a Yes campaign organisation. I thought it was pretty interesting. So this is what they're polling. I'm not sure exactly what the basis of this polling was, but this is as it was reported. Over 45% of Indigenous Australians have said they've heard very little or know nothing about the referendum, and 25% are saying that they're going to vote no. So that's 70% are either no or don't know. Now, that doesn't that completely cut across the message that this is something that Indigenous people are pushing and wanting?
Absolutely right. At the heart of the Yes case is this assertion that the voice is the universal request, the polite and gracious request, as the Prime Minister puts it, of Indigenous Australia. But plainly, Indigenous Australia is at least as divided and as confused about this damn thing as everyone else. And I think that's a very, very significant outcome, particularly because it is presumably an attempt by a pro-voice body to try to get to the truth, and good on them for trying to get to the truth. And in this case, the truth flatly contradicts the assertions of some of their fellow Yes campaigners.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Look, just related to that, also in this story, which I think is pretty interesting and revealing, look, clearly the Yes campaign is getting concerned about the polling. And there's reports here that Professor Langdon, now she was one of the authors of the Karma Langdon report that the Prime Minister repeatedly refers to as details. We've got some research coming out on the Karma Langdon report very shortly, which we'll discuss next time. But this is what Professor Langdon said. What we are doing with the voice is fixing the Constitution to ameliorate the racism of the Constitution, end quote. Now, what that racism is, she doesn't say. But doesn't this get to the point that so many of these activists that are designing the voice, they have this view that Australia is just a terrible racist place, and that's the whole basis of their outlook on this country, and anyone who's opposed to that, anyone who's opposed to changing it, is therefore also perpetrating this racism?
Correct. Now, I don't say that there have never been racist individuals in Australia, and I don't say that we have always got things right in respect of our policy and attitudes towards Indigenous people and indeed Indigenous Australia more generally. But let's never forget that the instructions of the British government to Governor Phillip were to live in amity with the native people. Mm-hmm. Let's never forget that in 1838 white men were hanged for the murder of black people after a trial in Sydney, a retrial in Sydney that the then Colonial Attorney General John Plunk had ordered. Let's not forget that colonial governors were constantly saying to the people on the fringes of settlement, who in some cases were grievously mistreating the Aboriginal people, that the Australian Aborigines have all the rights of British subjects. Now, we all know that what officialdom wants and what people actually get are not always the same. But nevertheless, there was never any institutionalised racism at the heart of the Australian project. Sure, there were the attitudes of the time, but compared to earlier attitudes, it was quite an enlightened liberalism that motivated those behind the settlement of Australia, and that's continued to this day. We only have the capacity to know our own current defects because the culture that shaped us gave us the potential for all these insights. So this idea that there's something fundamentally illegitimate and fundamentally racist at the heart of the Australian settlement, the Australian project, is just wrong.
No, it's well said, Tony, and a good place, I think, to move to our next topic, which is the current situation with the Victorian Liberal Party and Coalition, which is, of course, not just a Victorian issue. It's a warning to the country about what can happen when you don't stand up for your values and your principles and you don't get the big things right. So it's not just about the Victorian Liberal Party here. We know that the centre-right is at a low ebb politically. Culturally, economically, we're largely out of power. So it's a time of rebuilding. And so this is an instructive case of what not to do. According to a Resolve strategic poll released in The Age today, the Liberal Party's primary vote is now just 23%. That's down on what it was even at the most recent state election. The Coalition's primary vote, so the Liberal plus the National, is only at 26%. The report here says it can't get much lower. Unfortunately, it can. And Tony, to me, this is an example of what happens when you try to replicate policies of your opponents, whether it's in education or whether it's on the environment and climate change, and when you fail to stand up for values, as was the case with Moira Deeming and expelling her from the party, inevitably the community is going to mark you down for that, and that's what's happened. What are your reflections?
The first thing I want to say, Dan, is that the Liberal Party will recover, and the Liberal Party has been at a low ebb before. I can recall in New South Wales in the early 2000s, the Coalition's poll rating was 25%, even worse than it currently is here in Victoria. And yet in 2011, Barry O'Farrell had an all-time landslide win, and the Coalition then stayed in government for 12 years. And look, there's a lot that could have been done better, but still, they were in government in New South Wales for 12 years. So the Liberal Party will come back, but it's only going to come back if it creates a contest. Mm-hmm. It's only going to create a contest if it stands for things, and it's only going to stand for things if the people in it have got some convictions and some courage. And the problem here in Victoria, particularly over the last few years, is that it's far from clear what the Victorian Liberal opposition have stood for. In many instances, they seem to want to out-Labor Labor or out-Green the Greens. Yep. And I am completely perplexed, baffled, bewildered, discombobulated by the way my party here in Victoria has treated Moira Deeming. Now, look, agree with Moira Deeming or disagree with Moira Deeming, what she did was she went to a rally to defend the rights of women to their own safe spaces, women's change rooms, women's toilets, etc., that couldn't be accessed by biological males claiming to be women. Now, I think that's a perfectly reasonable position. It's J.K. Rowling's position. It's Martina Navratilova's position. These are not extreme right-wingers. These are not right-wing fringe dwellers. These are left-wing humanitarians who happen to think that this whole gender thing has gone way off track, and the rights that women quite properly fought for and were finally achieved in the last few decades are now being undermined by this campaign for trans rights. Now, I think we should treat everyone with respect. I think we should treat trans people with respect. I think many of them have shown enormous courage. I think of my friend Kate McGregor, enormous courage. And sometimes it's hard for people to understand the struggles that they've been through. But just because you respect the rights of trans people doesn't mean that you should transgress the rights of women to have their own safe spaces, to have their own sports competitions where they can compete against each other fairly, and not suddenly find themselves unfairly confronted with people who have an unfair advantage in sport, who have, you know, all the equipment of a biological male. Mm. Just not right.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. Mm. Just going briefly back to the sort of more redeeming situation, I mean, one of the things that you're very good at as opposition leader and as prime minister was getting talent and promoting talent. Mm-hmm. And I think to some people, they can be intimidated or put off by talent because it might outshine them. Mm-hmm. You were always very good at promoting people into positions who were good for the team. Mm-hmm. And that obviously enhanced you as the leader because they were performing well. I wonder whether an alternative scenario for John Pesutto would have been to say, look, Moira, you are talented, you're ambitious, you've got a lot of skill. Bring her into the team, give her a task, give her the opportunity to demonstrate the contribution she can make rather than pushing her to one side. I think it was the wrong thing. I think it's including these people of talent and capability rather than excluding.
Well, that's a very fair point, Dan. Look, I think part of the difficulty with Moira was that she's very new in the parliament and she's obviously got an abundance of courage. And high principles and good honour for both of those things. I'm not saying that she should have been put straight away on the front bench, but she certainly shouldn't have been ostracised and ultimately expelled because she had views that were quite reasonable, I think, and very strongly held. She could have been counselled, and yes, there are lots of tasks that you can give members of parliament. They can chair committees. They can be given special projects. They can be asked to make a big effort in terms of particular communities. I mean, one of the things that the coalition needs to do is strengthen its organisation in outer metropolitan areas. Even though more and more the Liberal vote is coming from outer metropolitan regional areas, the party organisation is still dominated from the inner city. And this is one of the reasons why we have, I think, a particularly acute issue with more progressive and more conservative Liberals at the moment. Mm-hmm. The votes are increasingly coming from more conservative people, but the party leadership tends to be more progressive. Now, historically, the Liberal Party flourishes when we've managed to bring the party together on issues where we can all agree. And I think I managed to do this by trying to ensure that, at least in my time as leader, climate was not so much a moral issue but an economic issue. I think if people are thinking about power prices, for instance, they suddenly become less obsessive about emissions. That's the task of leadership, frankly. It's to find things that unite your team and divide the other team. And unfortunately, here in Victoria, the Liberal leadership for quite a long time now has been much better at dividing Liberals than it has been at dividing and splitting and confronting the Labor Party.
That's right. Look, I would have thought Moira Deeming as Shadow Minister for women might not have been a bad
not a
move.
Not a bad idea.
Not a bad move. But yeah. Look, maybe another day. Look, let's move on to our last topic here, which I think is a really important one, which is to do with the presumption of innocence. And there's a couple of cases at the moment. We've obviously got Brittany Higgins, which is dominating the media, and also Ben Robert Smith, which to me is in many ways a more important and interesting case. So we might start with Ben Robert Smith.
Sure.
Now, look, just very briefly by way of background, Ben Robert Smith attempted to sue the Sydney Morning Herald, The Age and the Canberra Times for defamation. Now, he was unsuccessful in that. The justice of the trial found that the newspaper's allegations that Robert Smith had murdered civilians and bullied comrades during his deployments to Afghanistan were substantively true. Now, this is based on the balance of probabilities rather than the criminal higher
beyond
bar,
reasonable
beyond
doubt.
Reasonable doubt, thank you, that's there. Now, some in the media have reported this as proof that he's committed war crimes, which of course is an unfair bow to draw. Tony, you've often been a champion of those in our military and services who have given their lives and you know, given so much of the country. And I'd be really interested in your sort of insights and thoughts on the whole Ben Robert Smith matter.
Well, thanks, Dan. Look, it's not correct based on the judgment in this civil case to say that Ben Robert Smith is guilty of war crimes. You certainly could say that he's under a terrible cloud. And the personal tragedy for him is that he's been under a terrible cloud now for 5 or 6 years, ever since the Sydney Morning Herald first published these accusations. And he still hasn't actually been charged with anything, and nor have the others who the Brereton report says may well have been guilty of inappropriate conduct in Afghanistan. You know, one of the principles of our system is that you are innocent until proven guilty. Mm-hmm. One of the other principles of our system is that justice delayed is justice denied. Mm-hmm. And not only has Ben Robert Smith and his other Special Forces colleagues not been found guilty and therefore must at this point in time at least be presumed innocent, but certainly justice for them has been massively delayed. There was a report just this week in the Sydney Morning Herald that the criminal investigation, which had been going on apparently for 5 years, has had to be scrapped and restarted because of contaminated evidence. But apparently it's taken the DPP 2+ years, to come to a decision on this issue of contaminated evidence. And the whole process, according to the Sydney Morning Herald, has now got to be restarted. Well, you've got people like Ben Robert Smith, whatever mistakes they might have made, whatever crimes they have possibly committed, they're people who nevertheless wore our uniform and risked their lives. And if they did the wrong thing, they did it in the stress of war, almost unimaginably stressful for those of us who have never experienced it. And they're in limbo. And they've been in limbo for years now. And it looks like they're going to be in limbo for years to come. And this is just wrong. Now, plainly, our soldiers have got to conduct themselves in accordance with the rules of law, rules of war. You want your soldiers to be decent and honourable people, mm-hmm. even if they sometimes have to do terrible things. Mm. So I take my hat off to the Special Forces soldiers who were prepared to testify, but by the same token, I'm not prepared at this point in time to withdraw my respect and admiration for soldiers who may not always have been as good as they should have been, but nevertheless did tough things for our country. You know, I'm certainly very, very, very keen to avoid joining any pile-on against these people, because whatever mistakes they've made, we sent them to do difficult things. I think we put them in an impossible situation, particularly people like Ben Robert Smith, who did tour after tour after tour. I think they deserve our ongoing respect.
Mm. And just on a sort of separate but related matter, the Brittany Higgins issue, I mean, look, to me the whole thing's quite sad. I don't know what happened with or to Brittany, and I don't think we'll ever know, but clearly it's been, I think, used for nefarious reasons, political motives, and it's become such a, you know, such a political and media issue that I think that it's just so many people's lives have been caught
badly
up in,
badly damaged
in this. And again, it gets to your point about the presumption of innocence, where so many were wanting to jump on Bruce Lerman as an example of a broader cultural problem and political problem.
Yeah.
Just interested in your perspective on the matter, Tony.
Well, again, Dan, we don't know what happened on that fateful night in the minister's office. And as you say, we'll probably never know. There are two very different stories, On the one hand, nothing at all happened. On the other hand, something really dreadful happened. Who knows what the truth is? We do know that, rightly or wrongly, Brittany Higgins and her friends did their best to politicise and weaponise this whole thing. I think that's a pity, to put it at its mildest. But we also know that Bruce Lehrman, whatever mistakes he might have made and whatever wrongs he might have done, he has been through hell, absolute hell. And again, given that none of us are perfect and all of us make mistakes, and I think all of us should be given a fair go and the benefit of the doubt, I feel at least as sorry for him, frankly, as I do for Brittany Higgins, because both of them will carry the scars of this forever.
Yep. No, there's no winners out of this, Tony, unfortunately. So, look, we'll end it on that today, Tony. So appreciate your insights and advice and analysis as always. Look, I might just quickly, if it's all right with the guys in the studio, I'll just give a shout out to Mitch and Brandon in the studio that have set up this lovely new setting that we have here. They've done a really great job, and this is in response to the rapidly increasing views and engagement we're having with this podcast, Tony. So really excited about that, and we'll keep building up the studio. So just wanted to acknowledge that. And again, thank you for your time, Tony.
And Dan, look, thank you to you and to the IPA for giving me the chance to talk as we do. And yeah, you're right. Mitch and Brandon have done a great job, and it's going to get even better in the weeks ahead.
That's right. All right, Tony, lovely. Thanks for your time. Appreciate it, and we'll talk soon.
Thanks.
This is a production of the Centre for the Australian Way of Life at the Institute of Public Affairs. To find out more, visit australia.ipa.org.au.